Hello, welcome to Sinner Saint Sister. This is a space where searching, hurting, faithful, curious people come together and ask hard questions and listen to wise guests share how they have lived life deeply. There are a couple of things that you can do that really help out the show. One of them is if this episode is something that blesses you, can you please send it to a friend? Another thing is that if you really liked it, then could you please leave a 5-star review and write something nice? You can follow along at YouTube/Allison Sullivan for some really fun extras. Find me on Instagram at Allison M. Sully and TikTok at Sullivan Family TikTok. Thanks for being here. I hope you hear something today that lets you know you are loved and helps you love one another. Welcome to Sinner Saint Sister. If I had a redo as a high school senior, I think that I would spend more time naming my interests, discerning my strengths. I would make lists with asterisks. I would take personality tests and strength surveys. If I could go back in time, I would ask the adults around me what they thought made me special, if anything set me apart. And even if the answer to that was no, not necessarily, I would want to know if they noticed any correlation between my excitement, good mood, or curiosity around some employable skill. In short, I would have put far more energy and asked for way more advice around what in the world I was supposed to do with my life. What was I good at? What did I love? Could that skill and passion be put to work to provide an income that created a life where work wasn't work, but instead just spending the day living out my strengths? If you go on the podcast charts with Apple or Spotify, you will find that at least 3 of the top 10 podcasts are true crime related. And this fascination with true crime, it extends beyond podcasts. A recent study, for example, has shown that more than 50% of Americans enjoy true crime content. That same study found that 35% of Americans consume true crime content weekly. 62% of American adults report being fans of media, especially about serial killers. And the same survey found that 76 of American adults consider themselves fans of true crime. And I am a part of all of those percentages. And for me, I think it's more than just Darwinian, you know, like paying close attention for the evolutionary benefit. It's more than that. It's more than just some bolt of adrenaline it might provide, experiencing the novelty of fear without actually being in danger. It's more than that. For me, I think it's possible it's more than that, that what draws in the average consumer, because for me, I think I would have actually made a pretty kick-ass detective. I don't know. Maybe we're all out here playing Columbo, but I actually believe when I'm listening that I have things to add to the investigation. I think I've got the intuition to know when someone's lying and tactics to get them to open up. I can hyper-focus on details for really long periods of time, and I can obsess over solving a puzzle. I notice small things that end up not being small. I care about victims. I fixate on justice. Here's what I'm saying, friends. I want to trade in my armchair for an interrogation room metal folding chair. In a break from the norm on what you might expect from Sinner Saint Sister, I am interviewing a true crime expert, M. William Phelps, author of over 40 true crime books, way too lengthy list of TV work to get into here, producer, host, consultant, and the creator of the podcast Crossing the Line and the host of Paper Ghosts, both 2 of my very favorite podcasts. I had a blast, and I hope you love this too. Hello, M. William Phelps. It is such a delight to have you here. I have been following your work for such a long time. You're an investigative journalist. You are a crime writer with more than 40 books. Your TV work includes really impressive things, such as being a featured expert on dozens of shows, a consultant for Showtime's Dexter, and then, of course, Dark Minds on Investigative Discovery, which you produced and hosted, and following around serial killers, solving cold cases. I could go on and on, but we'd be here all day. This is such a delight. And like I said, I've been following your work for a long time, and it's a real honor to have you here. Welcome.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here. I really appreciate the invite. I've been around the true crime game a long time.
Yes, you have. Yes, you have. A lot of victim advocacy work, which I have a lot of respect for. Really, really, really appreciate that.
Thank you.
So for a more personal introduction, do you mind, for people that might be familiar with all of these things but might not know you quite as personally, do you mind introducing yourself personally to us by telling us a little bit about who and what you love?
Yeah, who and what I love. Well, right now I'm in love with Crossing the Line with M. William Phelps, my ongoing weekly podcast, which kind of allows me to expand on not only the cases I cover each week, but it allows me to offer my insight, what I've learned throughout the years. It allows me to bring in the vast array of contacts that I've met throughout the years, detectives, forensic people, DNA, psychologists, that sort of thing. So that's what I'm focused on now, because the show is just firing back up again. And, you know, and then there's Paper Ghosts, which is my investigative limited series podcast for iHeartRadio, iHeartMedia rather, that, you know, takes a long time. It takes to produce. It takes me a couple of years to produce one of those, you know, to do the investigation and and talk to all these people and, you know, and as you know, cut it together and do all that happy stuff, music, everything. But so that's really what I'm focused on. And I have a number of TV projects in the works that I've been developing with production companies, et cetera. But I mean, you said it earlier. I mean, I'm really focused on getting answers for families of victims who, you know, have unsolved cases or missing people, and they're just, you know, they're just tired and they haven't gotten any answers, and for no nefarious reasons.
Yeah. You're really attentive to grief. And I feel like you're also very respectful of and realistic, really, about the healing process. I feel like you...
Thank you.
Yeah, you take that on very well. And I don't know, I wanted to say, and I don't know that this is true or if you'd agree, but I feel like you're your truest self in Crossing the Line. And I feel like you're true everywhere, so that's maybe not a great description. Perhaps your most vulnerable self in Crossing the Line.
Yeah.
I just feel like we get the most of you there. And so I just want you to know that that's recognized and appreciated. And it's it really is one of my favorites, something I return to again and again and again.
Well, thank you very much. I genuinely appreciate that. I mean, it is my authentic self. It's how I feel. Sometimes I allow myself to just talk about how I feel about a guy.
Right.
This there's an episode coming up, I think next week, where, you know, this guy got a life sentence for murder and ended up doing 17 years, and then he got out and he killed like six more people. So that enrages me.
Sure.
That, I mean, we had this guy, right? Yeah. We had him in custody, and and our system let him out. So I get kind of excited when I hear stuff like that, and I allow it. Crossing the Line allows me to express that the way that I would in my living room.
Well, and to bring others along with you, because this matters. That is a righteous anger that we should all feel angry about. Anger is good. It points us to something that
That's
is wrong, and we can fix it, and we can gather together collectively. It's the point of podcasting. It's so great.
Very well said.
As humans, I feel like we have this fundamental fascination with good and evil, you know, and the difference in between. And so we have told stories about being chased by monsters for millennia, right?
I mean, monsters under the bed.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And so we like to be scared in this controlled way. And so I would love to know how you got started in your work, because while so many of us, it's like a universal experience that this kind of real life horror story is titillating to all of us, very few of us make it our work. So how did this come about for you?
I wish I had some dramatic, sexy story about how I got into true crime. But, you know, I say that the day before I got into true crime, I didn't really realize I was getting into true crime.
On accident.
I mean, what happened was, you know, my absolute love is to write. I mean, that has been my love since I started in my 20s, really approaching it in a more professional way. And you know, I had written a lot about music because I was kind of a musician. at one point, you know, hair band stuff in the 80s, that sort of thing. And well, Randy Rhoads from Ozzy. See, there you go. So I started writing about, because I've always been told, write what you know, which is just that's a fantasy. I mean, that is just bad advice for a writer, because as human beings, we don't know anything, right? So write what you want to know.
Yeah, stay curious. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I was writing about music, and then I started writing about politics. I started writing about anything. And I met an agent, a literary agent. He said, look, you're never going to make any money that way. If you want to make money and be a professional writer and a full-time job, you need to write a book. That's the only way. So I started to search around for a subject, and it just so happens I live in New England near Springfield, Massachusetts, and there was a trial going on. And I said, well, I'll attend this trial and I'll check it out and see if it's interesting to me. And it was a woman in her 30s, beautiful woman, her husband, a fireman, two little kids, a boat, cookouts. She volunteered at the homeless shelter. She ran a Secret Santa program. She was a nurse. She lived in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is kind of an artsy, like Austin. It's like an R Austin here.
Yeah.
She also went to work at night and killed people. So she was on trial for 7 murders. And so I started to look at this case, and I started to investigate this case and look really deep into it. And I found out she probably murdered 100 people, not 7, probably 100.
My goodness.
And it ended up becoming my first published book, which is called Perfect Poison, about Kristen Gilbert, which actually, she's not far from you. She's in Carswell, Texas, in the federal prison there. And so when that came out, it was successful. And I didn't realize I was writing a true crime book, to be perfectly honest. I just was writing a book about interesting people in this interesting town and murder. And it was successful. So, of course, when you're successful in publishing books, you go with that. So I went with it. And here we are 20-something, 5 years later, whatever.
Fascinating. If this is uncomfortable for you, I can edit starting here. But then also, just as I know, in a strange turn of events, this is quite personal for you.
Yeah.
Do you mind talking here?
No, about not at your all. Not at all.
I wouldn't think so. Just you're open about it in your platforms. So, yeah. But I wanted to make sure today was a good day to do that.
Of course. Thank you very much.
So do you mind letting us in on how this has become all so personal?
My sister-in-law, my brother's wife, was 5 months pregnant, and she was strangled to death in Hartford, Connecticut in 1996. And her case remains unsolved, though they're very close to solving it from what I understand now. Wow. And you know, that's not something that drove me into true crime, but it's something that I can sit with a victim's family and I can understand what they're going through, because I've seen this in my own family, right? Yeah. I've seen it with my niece and nephews and extended family. And my brother also, he died years later.
Yeah.
And I say, I said in my book, Dangerous Ground, which I talked about this stuff, was it was like the longest suicide I've ever seen in my life, you know, because he kind of just went downhill after she was murdered. So, so he did things that people do to numb themselves, medicate, and he wound up dying, as so many people do today, from drugs.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, honestly speaking, when she was murdered, me and her were at each other's throats. I mean, I had taken her kids away from her.
Yeah.
I had gone to probate court, taken my brother and her kids away. So later on, when I started to write about this, I felt different about it now. You know, I wasn't in my 20s anymore, you know.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned Dark Minds. And when I was filming Dark Minds, we would go on the road for like 3 months a year to film that show, right? And day after day, I would sit in people's living rooms and interview family after family who like lost a 13-year-old kid from murder or, you know, and it would just, I could relate to their pain, but it was very, very, it weighed heavily on me that doing that day after day after day.
I would imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. But her case is close to being solved, is what I'm told. Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that. I know that you are skeptical of the term closure. as there really isn't quite such thing. Yeah, yeah. And even if there is a resolute result, it doesn't bring anyone back. And I'm so sorry that that is a part of your story. And I would never celebrate tragedy or grief, but I certainly celebrate your resiliency and how you have used it and brought it into your work. Do you have an explanation, Phelps, for why this genre has blown up the way that it has? Is this really just about, is this something as simple as gathering intel? Is there just like a biological response? I mean, we're all trying to do the same thing out here, which is not die, you know? Like, what's this about?
I think you touched upon it opening up the show. You talked about something and it occurred to me, and I mentioned this in Paper Ghost 4, which just started now, that we like to put a face on evil. We need to have a face. Yeah. You know, we need to see evil, a face.
And there's power in naming things.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And we could debate all day about, you know, do people like the mystery of true crime? Do they like the gruesome, you know, and I'm sure there's a little bit of that in the audience, you know? So, but I wrote about this for, I'll whisper it, AARP a while back.
Listen, I've gotten my letters in the mail. We're good. Solidarity, friend.
They asked me to write about the same question. And, you know, look, I mean, since I was a kid, I watched Scooby-Doo. I loved Scooby-Doo.
Right. Yeah.
What are they doing on Scooby-Doo? They're solving a mystery, right? Yeah. From there, for me, it went to Columbo, which I just loved. And the great thing about Columbo is this. Within the first 2 minutes of that show, you know who the killer is. But you stay in it for 90 more minutes to see how he figures it out.
Yeah.
Right? So a lot of times when people are watching true crime, they know these cases. They know who the killer is. You watch the Idaho, you know, whatever, a murder, whatever the case is, right?
Yeah, right.
You know who the killer is. But you're in it to see how it was solved, the pieces put together, I think.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So there's really no one answer to that question.
Yeah, really. I agree. I also think what makes, this is an oversimplification, but what makes someone a sinner is so much more interesting than what makes someone a saint.
Absolutely.
You know, this is humanity's like largest taboo, right? And so, you know, to be able, there's a lot of curiosity in that. There's a lot of curiosity in this such a left turn from what is societally appropriate, from the norms, I guess.
It's true. I mean, and to hit on what you said, you know, we don't pay attention to the saintly stories about saints that did great things, but we do pay attention to the saints that were sinners and then became saints.
More. A little rascally. That's right.
Yeah. 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 So because we're all, right? We all sin. We all do stuff that is just, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so... yeah, I agree with you 100% on that.
Do you have any thoughts on this? Because, and I don't even know that this is statistically true. I think you would. Is this more applicable or attractive to women? Because I feel, just anecdotally, it is me and my women friends that are like, do you think that we should be private investigators, though? Because I feel like maybe... I have a lot of hidden talents that could maybe, you know, but I think that there's maybe it's possible that there's, you know, just what I touched on earlier about the intel gathering of like, okay, let's stay alive, ladies, you know, but then, and you, this is a slippery slope because you don't want to get victim blamey, but then there's an aspect of, oh yeah, see, I would have picked that up sooner. I would have never dated him that long. I would have only needed one red flag instead of the, you know, but what do you think about the gender differential?
I'll answer you the last part of that first, and that is, generally speaking, when evil is the closest to us, it's the hardest for us to see. It's when it's farther away, like you're explaining, on TV, you know, reading a book, whatever, you can easily spot it. But if you're living with it every day, it can lie to you easier, right?
Yeah.
So, because it knows you. Now, to answer your other question, I know this for a fact, because if you look at my list of books, 30 of them are focused on female murderers. And there's a reason for that. And that's because the audience for those books is mostly female.
Yeah.
When I give talks and I do book tours, 95% of the audience is female, and the other 5% are probably just tagged along with one of their wives or something.
Right, so, right, yeah.
So this audience is largely female for sure. Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think it's empowering in some ways, you know, mm-hmm. and you know, mm-hmm. the more educated we are about a subject, the more we feel confident, the more we feel secure. So yeah, yeah.
What about this? Is it, I don't know. I'm guessing now. This is so off script and has nothing to do with anything that I thought we were going to talk about, but I kind of love it for that. Is it possible? So if you think about the armchair detective, right? If you think about the person who is sitting around and wishing that they could be the one, because we want to solve the case too, when we want to do it like on the same terms, you know, we want to, you know, be the one asking the questions and all of that. And I think that what would make someone a good investigator, and I don't know that I'm right, again, I'm speculating, is a certain amount of intuition. So if I think that I have great intuition, I think that I can easily pick out, I can feel like I can tell if you're lying to me. I feel like I, you know, now what my husband would argue is that the problem with a person with good intuition is that they can't be talked out of their intuition. So there's maybe some problems there. But when it comes to the armchair detectives, I think that what makes someone think they would be good at this is someone who recognizes that they have good intuition.
Yeah.
So many times that's women, right? That feel like they have good intuition.
Yeah. Women definitely have a keener sense of intuition, I think, than most men. I would agree with that wholeheartedly. But the detectives that I have met and I have spent a lot of time with, they rely on their intuition, their gut. I mean, it's you know, I've had detectives tell me, you know, I just sat across from this person for an hour and I just knew that this person was my guy. You know, I knew it. Yeah. I knew it from the way he talked, the way he looked at me, cat and mouse game he was playing. So there's definitely, but you know, your husband is right as well, because you can't allow blinders to be put on with that intuition. You can't have tunnel vision. You know, if the evidence comes in and points you away from your intuition, you got to follow that evidence. So mm-hmm. you can't just rely on one thing, you know?
Yeah.
And detectives are a special breed of law enforcement. You know, they would make probably really bad patrol officers, you know, and patrol officers would make very bad detectives. There's a reason why they're detectives, you know? Right. So a lot of times when I'm with detectives, and it's not even like you're with a cop, it's not even like they're law enforcement, you know, it's, they're a different kind of person.
Yeah, altogether. I get that. So. What do you think makes a good detective? If I were to play with the idea that I've missed my calling and I should have been a detective, the things that I think would make me good at that are the intuition. And then I think I have a good rapport with people where I can get people to talk to me. I think that I can, and a connection. I think I have skills to do that. What do you think makes a good investigator?
Okay, those two things are important, but
yes.
One of the most important things is to be able to, because look, detective work is dead end after dead end after dead end, no pun intended. Just, you're going down a road and you're just hitting dead ends, that, you know, you're running into walls all over the place and you're just searching for that 2-4-6% of the time when bang, something falls into place.
Yeah.
So you have to have a lot of patience and you have to be able to resign yourself to sitting in an office for weeks at a time, going through documents, going through phone records, and being able to bring passion to that every single day that you do it. Mm. That's what most people don't see, is that tedious work. You know, it's like forensic genetic genealogy. We see the big stories that of the cases being solved. What we don't see is the people hours that are behind it.
Right.
Because the science part of it is really a small part. You know, there's a lot of research, like paper research that's involved in it, you know, making family trees, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
So it's really tedious. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for that. What do you think? So my husband was a physician during COVID, and there, you know, what the internet allows us to do is become experts. And so there were so many instances where everyone was an expert except the experts during that time. And so I'm curious, what do you think law enforcement thinks of all these podcasts, of all these people weighing in? Are they grateful for it? Are they annoyed by it? Do we have avenues that maybe they don't have and they're grateful? I don't know.
Well, the ones that I meet and I interview for my podcasts are really happy that I'm there to help, that I'm able to bring something. But
that's specific to you.
Yeah. I mean, I have a reputation of being, you know, a stand-up journalist and victims advocate, et cetera. And my work speaks for itself, so they can go back and listen to it, right? So, or they can read it or whatever. But as far as a lot of the stuff, from what I hear, they're not happy with a lot of it because there's so much speculation going on in true crime today, more so on social media than, say, in podcasting. But
sure, sure.
There's nothing worse to me than someone who has a laptop and a microphone and they start talking about true crime and think that they know what they're talking about when they've never, ever, you know, looked at a police report or interviewed anybody or anything like that. It can really hurt a case.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So when I say everyone's an expert except the experts, I want you to know I consider you an expert.
That's a great comment.
Yeah. I just think there are things probably popping up everywhere that are, I would imagine, are quite annoying, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And once in a while, of course, a bullseye gets struck on one of these podcasts and someone, you know, brings some great information, but there can be information overload too, right? In cases, there can be too much information.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
You know? But it's a tight wire rope to walk.
Speaking of tight wires, one thing that is necessary for me as I consume and try to be thoughtful about it, I am not able to intersect true crime and comedy. I can't do it.
Yeah.
I don't, it's not funny to me.
Yeah.
So there is I feel like the genre has an ethics problem, and I know that you won't disagree with me there. It is often operating without the consent of the people at the center of the story. We can tend to glamorize suspects, we can misrepresent victims. There are so, I say we, and I'm not in this genre at all, but there are so many things that can go wrong. What is it? Are there things that bother you about all of this drama, and how should we be careful about what we consume?
Yeah, I kind of covered some of this in the first new episode of Crossing the Line, where I talked about how the Long Island Rex Uerman's wife signed a deal with NBC for $1 million to be followed by cameras. So I use that as the basis for talking about this. So what she's done is she signed a deal for $1 million to be followed by cameras throughout his trial and going in to visit him and, you know, afterward. Now, I rage about it in this episode because what you've done is you've just said that the serial killer is more important story than the victims right off the top, right? And we shouldn't be rewarding serial killer victims' families for being related to a guy who murdered people. And look, I agree that they suffered trauma and you know, they're victims too. But you know what? We don't need to fucking watch it on TV and pay someone $1 million. We don't need to do that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just not right. So yeah, the ethics of true crime I've always been attacked myself as an ambulance chaser, that sort of thing. I don't care what people say. I don't give a shit what people say. I know what I do. My work speaks for itself. I don't have any problem with that. But you know, when I see things like this $1 million deal and the lawyers being paid a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Right. Yes.
And the kids being paid a couple hundred thousand dollars.
Yes.
To appear in this, I'm enraged. You know, this should not happen. And it also taints all this evidence that they could purportedly bring to a trial. Mm-hmm. Right. Because now they're now, like I said in this episode of Crossing the Line, I said, you know, they're not paying her to talk about gardening and going out to eat at the OK Corral with this guy.
What was it like? Yeah.
Right. She had to bring something substantial to the table before they'd give her that deal. It wasn't just based on who she is. Right. I'm sure she had to bring something substantial. I've dealt with these people who she signed a deal with. I know these people and what they want from a deal. Mm-hmm.
And so that's the answer to the question, because a devil's advocate would say, well, aren't they victims too? Right?
They are.
And that's the answer to the question, though. If that were the real question, if that were the real pushback, the answer would be, we're not talking about her hobbies. We're talking, the real reason is, what was it like to share a bed with da-da? So this is just a back door. Because we have a law against this, right? Like Son of Sam law. Son of Sam, right? So we have.
It's not for the families. It's for the killer.
This is a back door, if you ask me.
Yeah,
let's talk to the wife to get to Rex.
You're exactly right.
Same.
Now, this, mind you, when months before this deal, she refused to visit him. She files for divorce. She says, I want nothing to do with him. And all of a sudden, now seven figures is dangled in front of her. And it's like, well, now I do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's. So the whole idea of it is, and I don't think people want to see this anyway, right? You know, I don't think viewers of Netflix or NBC, Paramount, wherever this is going to show, I don't think they want to see this sort of point of view anyway.
So that's my question. What's our responsibility? Has our appetite become insatiable?
Right. I think not only that, but you know, I mentioned this in the episode. It's like, for guys like me or anybody, creators, executive producers like me who create this content. Now the bar set at that. I can't produce that. And I would never
and
do
I
it
won't.
If I could.
That's
right. Right. So there's just so much wrong with this. So much wrong with it. Yeah. And it cheapens the entire genre, I believe. But yeah, so I raged about that. Yeah.
I know that you and I could go on and on and on about botched, blocked investigations around Gilgo Beach and double lives, corruption, ego, everything happened, all the cover-ups in Suffolk County. I mean, we could go on and on.
oh my God.
I know. Oh, yeah.
I did a Dark Minds episode on it like 12 years ago when no one really heard about it.
Yes.
You know,
well, and this is what I love about you is you take on, I will immediately skip a Dateline episode that I already know that story. So I love that you're choosing intentionally. You choose to dive deep in things that are lesser known. So I've always appreciated that about you.
Yes, I do.
So before we move on to how to support you, how to support your work, where you want us to follow the closest, before we do that, can you leave us with something that you're hopeful for?
Yeah. What I'm hopeful for is that labs like Othram Labs, every day in the news, we see Othram has identified another missing person who has been missing for 30 years, or they've helped solve another case. And they do this a lot of times with grants from the government, from cities, or they do it pro bono. They do it for free. Mm-hmm. And I just hope that that technology that they're using, which is novel, which is very unique, I hope it just can spread and spread and spread, and that some of these families, because remember, a missing person, right? You're a family of a missing person. You know they're dead, but you don't know they're dead. You know, this person's spirit is just floating around somewhere in the universe, waiting for someone to find him or her and have them land in a cemetery next to their family.
Yeah.
And I think labs like Othram, they can help do that exponentially. They can really open up the door to that because it's happening every single day now with technology. Mm-hmm. So that's my hope, is that, you know, the amount of cases that we can close, because there's cold cases out there, I can't stress this enough, that can be closed, but they need someone to just blow off the dust, take them out of the freezer and open them.
Yeah.
But there's just not the funding, budgets, mm-hmm. person power to do that. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. my hope is that we can get there with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I am hopeful for that along with you. Where would you like us to follow the most closely? What's your current baby? I already know the answer to this and I'm already doing it, but I want listeners to hear it from you. What are you most excited about and how can we support you?
Crossing the Line.
Crossing the Line. Do it, friends. Go subscribe.
Subscribe to Crossing the Line. Crossingtheline.biz. You can get it there and find everything else from there, you know, paper ghosts.
Yes.
Yeah. So I want to just thank you very much for having me. It was a wonderful surprise to see your text message. And I really appreciate it.
I really appreciate your time so much. I love paper ghosts. I'm waiting for the next episode, but Crossing the Line is my staple. It's my go-to. I return to it. Start at the beginning, friends. Work your way through if you haven't started listening already. Phelps, in a world where it really feels impossible to keep up with what's going on in the world and journalism appears to be compromised and news feels slanted and information gathering in general, it feels troubled as an institution. It feels unreliable and it simply does not do what it claims to do. And so it feels very refreshing to be able to rely on a person, a trustworthy person who's going to tell it true with integrity and with values, with an intrinsic moral code to do it well.
Oh, thank you.
It is very refreshing. And I hope that you never quit doing what you're doing. So grateful for you. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure.
Good. Hopefully we can keep in touch. Sully and Phelps.
Sully and Phelps. I'm going to pitch it as a British crime drama.
Sully Perfect. And Phelps. Thank you. Good morning, Beefinator. How are you?
Hi, Beefy Beef. This episode was so fun for me. Not only because it was like, yeah, it was like a new topic for the show, but you were so preciously enthusiastic. So I didn't actually watch y'all. I only listened to it. And I swear I could like hear the twinkle in your eyes. You were like leaning in to like look behind the curtain with him. It was awesome.
Yes, I love it. Well, you know, I mean, I am always trying to start my private investigation firm. Mm-hmm, I'm always trying to find a partner because I feel like this would be a lot more fun, you know, to do with someone else. And I'm really only half kidding.
Yeah, no, Beef. And I'm so sorry. I cannot be that friend.
I totally know this. And you are safe, I promise. But I will undoubtedly rope you into this investigation somehow. Like, you know, if I'm not making you hide in bushes with me, fine. But you'll be involved somehow.
Beef, I feel like surveillance is just really boring.
It is. I've been warned. I've been told that. That's okay. Listen, listeners, if you have a cheating husband, I don't care if it's boring. I'm your woman. You let me know. Yes. Yes. I've got this.
Okay. So do you feel like you've missed a calling? Because I have a few things to say about this.
No, I don't. I really don't. Because, okay. I feel like your passions find you. They kind of hunt you down. You know what I mean? So like, I thought about this, not, and this is a bad example because I have no interest in nursing, but like, I remember thinking there are so many things that I get to do because of motherhood. So like, I'm thinking of the person who, you know, isn't getting to pursue their nursing career the way that they might've wanted because they really also want to be home with their kids. Well, there's a lot of nursing in motherhood, you know? Mm-hmm. So anyways, I guess what I'm saying is that I have a podcast. Like I can really kind of do whatever I want. You know, there's a lot of opportunity. So I don't feel like I've missed any calling.
So I just, hold on. Yes. Am I hearing the beginnings of a true crime podcast?
Definitely not. This is way too saturated of a market.
That's true.
Yeah, my voice is not needed. However, if like, you know, Tenderfoot or iHeartMedia or something, I mean, if they were looking for some sort of sassy brunette and I, you know, were to throw my name in a hat, I certainly would not listen. Or listeners, do you have a cold case? Anyone mm-hmm. have a cold case? You want to hand me some files?
She's your girl. Yeah. Okay. One thing that I did think was interesting that came up for me in the interview, or that I really focused on in the interview, is how thoughtful he is about giving victims a voice, right?
Always.
Yeah. I thought about it like with my job, right? So I'm in civil litigation, not on the criminal side at all where he lives, but even in the work that I do, the rules of evidence are intended to make sure that lawyers are only able to introduce reliable evidence, like to the jury on behalf of their clients, right? Mm-hmm. And so in cases that I've been involved in, there's certain evidence that can't come in because, you know, for an example, there's a question as to its authenticity, right? Is it mm-hmm. the real email that person really sent the other person? And there are similar rules in the criminal context about admissible evidence. And so in both criminal and civil spaces, the rules sometimes require evidence to be excluded that actually is reliable and would be helpful to a jury. Mm-hmm. But for one reason or other, right, it doesn't meet that standard. Yes. So like in the civil world where I live, the consequence of that is that maybe someone doesn't recover as much as they should have under a contract, right, for the contract dispute that I'm dealing with. But obviously in the criminal space, the consequences are far more dire.
Yeah.
And so these rules really change what ends up in court and what then in turn would end up in the media, right? Because usually it's these court cases that are followed. But I'm grateful that he is using his platform to just push all that aside, right? And just be able to tell the stories as they actually happened and be able to give victims the voice that they deserve. So I loved hearing about that.
Yeah, it is. It's so interesting to me because of all the things that can go wrong in an investigation, that is one of the most infuriating things where you're like, the jury mm-hmm. needed to hear that.
Right.
They needed to hear about this criminal past that was escalating, you know. And so, but this is another example of things that can go wrong in an investigation that's completely infuriates me. I think this one is the most, is this idea of a good victim and bad victim, you know, mm-hmm. like as a jury, it might be really important to us that our victims have never committed a crime themselves or that they're always, you know, compliant or alcohol free or a good mother, that they don't get angry. You know, they're not mentally ill or experiencing homelessness or whatever. And so that is another thing that I feel like he has really been a good advocate and used his voice to help work against is, nope, this should be a consistent pursuit.
Right. I mean, we're all human, right? Life is complicated. And certainly abuse, violence, murder should all be pursued consistently, regardless of who is experiencing it.
Yes, that. Well, thanks for this deep dive with me, Beef. It was so fun.
That was fun episode. While I don't think I'm ever going to fall asleep to true crime like you do, it definitely gets my mind off of a treadmill, and I'm certainly going to be subscribing to Crossing the Line. He was awesome.
Yes. All right. Thanks, Beef. See ya.
Bye.
I am so, so grateful for you, listener. If you liked this episode, could you please do me a favor and hit subscribe and leave a review? It really helps the show grow, and I would be so appreciative. Thank you so much to our guests who share their gifts so generously with us, and a special thank you to Taylor Schroll, who does so much behind the scenes to make the show great. If it weren't for him, I would still be in my closet with my iPhone. You can follow along at Forte Catholic as well. That's Taylor's show where I show up now and again. And to keep up more regularly, please follow along on Instagram at Allison M. Sully or TikTok at Sullivan Family TikTok. See you next week.
Today's show was a production of Allison Sullivan in conjunction with the Forte Catholic Podcast Network. For more great Catholic podcasts, head on over to fortecatholic.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.